something so intense, so volatile in his feelings toward Lace, that he simply tries to shut his feelings down. Deep stuff. Some of the stuff you dealt with when courting me. Really? Absolutely. What happened? He asked, smiling in the dark. How did we end up in the same bed? She patted his hand. Water wears away stone. He yawned hugely. Whatever that means, he said. He sat in a straight-backed chair, in a small, empty room with a dirt floor. It was the same cool, hard-packed floor of his grandmother's potato cellar, but there were windows through which light streamed, casting patterns at his feet. He heard a door opening behind him. Children filed into the room on either side of his chair. They came in silently, almost reverently, and settled themselves at his feet, as if waiting for him to speak, to tell them a story or solve some great riddle. There were dozens of children, many more than a small room could possibly hold, but their silence made them seem fewer. The light from the open doorway fell upon their hair and illumined their faces as they looked at him, searching for something he had no ability to name or to deliver. He tried to speak, but couldn't open his mouth. He tried, but could not speak. "What is it, dearest?" Her hand on his shoulder was the most reassuring touch he'd ever known, save that of his mother. "I keep falling asleep and waking again. Did I disturb you?" "You were dreaming," she said. "I've been awake, too. It's the change that's coming."
"It's already with us," he thought. "We have disrupted something precious, something fragile." Yet they were doing what they believed God wanted.
"Come," he said, taking her into his arms. They lay without talking as he stroked her cheek.
"I'm going with you to New York," he said at last.
"You don't have to. It's all right."
"No, we're going together.
To arrive in Tennessee in early June and leave the middle of July didn't seem the best thing, but he was going with his wife, period. As for his lifelong fear of flying, he'd put his head down and do it. He'd reckon with it. She kissed him tenderly. "I'll be proud to show off my husband." He turned his head on the pillow and looked out the window to the leaves of the maple tree gleaming in the moonlight. Whitecap didn't seem so hard. "We were light-hearted about going to Whitecap," she murmured. "The freedom of an island.
The wind in our hair.
Gulls wheeling above us.
The smell of salt air."
He completed their old liturgy. Whitecap had seemed inviting and open. What lay ahead now seemed closed, though he didn't know why.
"This will be our last foray," he said.
"Thank you, Timothy. We're no spring chickens."
Ah, yes. He would be 69 in less than a month, looking square into the maw of the big 70. But age had nothing, less than nothing, to do with serving God. There were countless older saints who, faithful to the end, had perished on the mission field. And there were mission fields at home, right in his own backyard. Hadn't he always been a proponent of the local mission field? After Tennessee, he would get down to it once and for all. He would find his niche and make his mark for God at home in Mitford. What with 2 days at the Children's Hospital in Wesley, a couple of days with Scott Murphy at Hope House, Wednesdays with Homeless Hobbs's soup kitchen,
and a pulpit here and there, he'd have more than a full plate.
"Let me pray for us," he said, smoothing her hair from her forehead. The faintest scent of wisteria rose from her flesh, evanescent but consoling. He'd be able to locate his wife anywhere, even blindfolded in a crowded air terminal. Her smell had become the smell of home to him, of peace and certainty. "Lord," he said, "to you all hearts are open, all desires known, and from you no secrets are hid. We can hide nothing from you, yet something is hidden from us. Speak to us again, Father. Help us discern your direction for our lives. Are we on the path you've set for us? Have we missed the mark?" They lay still then, hearing the ticking of the clock, and Barnabas snoring on the hall landing. Buck Leeper dropped by the following morning, on his way to the construction site in Holding. He stood at the front door, holding a to-go cup of coffee, looking exhausted and apologetic.
"I figured you'd be up."
"Since 5:30, said Father Tim. "What is it, my friend?"
"Could we sit out here and talk?"
They thumped onto the top step of the front porch.
"I had a big run around yesterday. I thought I'd found Kenny. Somebody on my job said they'd seen a bunch of paintings on velvet up around Elizabethtown. Said they were propped against a van in an empty lot, and signed Kenny Barlow."
Though the mission had clearly failed, a bolt of adrenaline surged through Father Tim. Buck swigged the coffee.
"I started to call you, but there was no time. I just jumped in the truck and went for it. I drove up there and found the van. My heart was pumping like a jackhammer. And then this kid came out, probably around Sammy's age. It was all I could do to keep from busting out crying."
"But?"
"But the boy's name was Wayne. His daddy's name was Kenny Barlow. No E. I met his daddy, a pretty decent guy down on his luck. I bought a painting of a deer head. It's rolled up behind the seat in the truck."
"Well done."
"I don't know about you, but I'm ready to quit on this."
Father Tim took a deep breath.
Quit. That's what he was about to do as well. But it would do no good to quit, no good at all.
"Let's don't quit," he said. "Let's don't quit."
Buck set the cup on the step between his feet. "A few days ago I asked Pauline to tell me everything she could remember about the boys, like if they had any birthmarks and the color of their eyes."
"Good thinking."
"She couldn't remember the color of their eyes."
There was a long silence between them.
"When she realized she couldn't remember the color..."
Buck hunched over, his head in his hands.
"It was the alcohol, of course. All those years."
"Those years are behind you."
"Yeah, they are, thank God."
Buck looked at him.
"But you pay the consequences."
"True. But now God is in the consequences with you. Otherwise, you're in them alone. Desperately alone."
Buck stood up. "Forgive me for making a rough start to your day, Father. Finding a needle in a haystack ain't ever been my long suit."
The men walked to the truck together.
"I saw something on TV last night," said Father Tim. "It happened right after the Second World War, when nobody had any money. A sewing machine company held a contest. Whoever found the needle hidden in a haystack would win a brand new sewing machine." There were people swarming all over that haystack. Hay was flying everywhere. And guess what?
What?
The chances were one in a million. But somebody found the needle.
Buck laughed his water-boiling-in-a-kettle laugh. Oh, yeah?
Yeah, said Father Tim, beaming. Dear Timothy, we're elated that you and Cynthia will be arriving only a few days hence. Have done as you asked, and scraped up a rug. It appears that dogs have chewed one end of it, but you can pop that end under a piece of furniture. Be it ever so humble, I'm sure you'll be pleased with your Quonset hut. My lodge in the Canadian wilds wasn't half so commodious. I hope you don't mind that I mounted my moose head on your living room wall, as my own quarters, being humbler still, had no room for it. I'm living 4 miles away, and trust you'll let me visit the old thing when the mood strikes. Jack Ferrier, a primitive Baptist, who knows these coves and firths like the back of his hand, will be taking you around on Monday following to visit your new parish. Some areas don't have bridges. You'll be driving through creek beds, so bring your waterproofs. Spaghetti supper on arrival, courtesy of yours truly. Be assured, Timothy, that God is working in Jessup, Tennessee. In his service, Father Harry. P.S. Could you possibly bring mosquito netting? Enough for 2 Cavanaughs and 1 Roland ought to do the trick. Richard and Trudy are bringing their own. He decided he wouldn't bother his wife with this latest communication from the mission field. He opened the refrigerator and spied his lunch of freshly made chicken salad with hard-cooked eggs and celery, his favorite combination. No nuts and grapes for him, thank you. He peeled back the saran wrap and nabbed a carrot stick and shut the door. Lunch would wait till he returned from Meadowgate. He wasn't as ravenously hungry since he cut back on his insulin a few days ago. If his sugar started acting up, he'd do the 10 extra units again. Which reminded him, he needed to stop at the drugstore and pick up a glucometer. It had been on his list for days. And his jogging, he needed to get back to it. He was due in 5 minutes to meet Dooley and follow the Wrangler to Meadowgate Farm. The boy could have driven out alone. He was 19 years old, for heaven's sake, but he wanted to go with him, as he'd done all those years ago when he left Dooley at Meadowgate and traveled to Ireland to meet Walter and Catherine. They found Hal and his associate, Blake Edistow, in emergency surgery with a border collie. After a visit on the porch with Marge and 7-year-old Rebecca Jane, he and Dooley walked to the creek, to the very place they'd said goodbye before. Dooley had been only 11 then. He remembered sitting with him on the creek bank and talking, his heart heavy. Was it so different now? "Well, son," he said, "I'll maybe write you or something. Would you? We'll write you back. And we'll call, of course. I believe it will be a good summer for both of us." They sat on a large, smooth stone embedded in the creek bank. Dooley picked up a stick and slapped the water, precisely as Father Tim remembered him doing years ago. "How will you get on with Blake?" There had been more than a clash or two with Hal's associate. While Dooley veered toward a more natural practice of veterinary medicine, Blake was staunchly committed to traditional treatments. "I'll do my thing. He'll do his." "Seems fair enough. He needs to keep his nose out of what I do, that's all." "Still fair enough.
but it might be good to swap ideas along the way. Hal would keep the two in line. He was well aware of the friction between them. As Hal's own medical theories were drawn from tradition, he often sided with Blake. But Dooley's fresh perspectives intrigued the seasoned vet, and he gave the boy plenty of rein. Dooley slapped the water with the stick. "What do you think about Sammy and Kenny?" He would not, could not tell Dooley what he thought. He thought that finding them may be a closed chapter. "I don't know. Buck and I will do everything we can. Just because I'm going away doesn't mean I won't think about it, pray about it, and try to come up with something." Dooley gazed at the water. "What can I do?" Father Tim sighed. "I don't know," he said. "I don't know." Sammy and Kenny might be two grains of sand on a beach that stretched to the horizon. Dooley raised his head and looked at Father Tim. "I'm going to try and come up with something," he said with finality. "Tim!" Hal Owen waved from the front door of his clinic. "Tim, before you go."
"Yes?"
Hal walked quickly toward Father Tim. "Sorry we didn't get to visit.
How's the collie?"
"He'll make it. He was torn up pretty badly by some dogs across the creek, but he'll be fine. Listen, something to think about." He didn't need another thing to think about. "Marge and I would like to go to France next year and take Rebecca Jane. We'd leave sometime before Christmas." Hal removed his glasses and stuck them in the pocket of his blood-stained surgical smock. "We've been invited to run the practice of a college chum for a year, while they take a similar post in Italy. We were talking last night. We wondered if you and Cynthia might care to farm-sit."
Farm-sit? He'd never sat a farm.
"You'd be 15 minutes from Mitford in your Mustang, 25 if you use the pickup. Might be interesting. I know how Cynthia likes to sketch out here. Joyce Havner comes every Monday and Friday to clean house. There are two churches right down the road."
"Aha."
"Dooley would be here for the summer, of course, and Blake would be around full-time to manage the practice. There wouldn't be any farm work involved. Lewis would do the bush hogging, Sam Rayner the milking, Bo Davis the odd jobs, business as usual. If the notion strikes, you might take a few eggs out of the nests every morning."
"Aha,"
he said again. His mind was jello. "Plus, Meadowgate would be a great place to work on those essays you mentioned."
"I don't know. I'd have to..."
"Pretty soft job, all things considered."
"Right. Well..."
"No need to make a decision now. It's just something to think about." Hal slapped him heartily on the shoulder and gave him a hug. "Take care, old friend. The Lord be with you."
"And also with you,"
said Father Tim, hugging back. Though time was short, he took the long way home. He wanted to think. He'd been in a kind of funk the last few days. A gray fog seemed present in his brain. It came to him that he was terribly thirsty, as if something in his very soul had been deprived for a long time. Why wasn't he taking his wife on a cruise instead of hauling her to Tennessee? He envisioned a ship's passengers lined up in deck chairs, broiling like chops. No, no way. He could never do it. He and Cynthia did little to amuse themselves because there was so much he didn't like. He didn't like flying.
He didn't like the thought of lining up in deck chairs. He didn't like Cynthia's occasional enthusiasm to see Spain or France, or even return to Maine, the scene of their honeymoon. What had she gotten herself into? A celebrated author tied to a man as dull as dishwater and entirely self-serving. In truth, he was too pathetic even to play golf. Didn't retired clergy have a fondness for golf? He thought so. He seemed to recall he'd heard a lot of golf talk around diocesan meetings, about how terrific it was to keep the mind alert, the body strong. Look at Stuart Cullen, for example, a golfer, and fit as any boy. Yet, in the end, "Throw me in the briar patch," he muttered aloud, "anything but golf." He mopped his brow with his handkerchief and cranked the air conditioner a notch higher. It was the same unbearably tiresome nonsense he'd wrestled with for years. He didn't know how to do anything on the side of fun, didn't have a clue how to instigate it. It was Cynthia who dragged him into fun like a sack of potatoes. Hadn't she come up with those famous clergy retreats? Small treasuries of time to laugh, to unwind, to refresh themselves? Had he ever come up with a retreat for her benefit? Not that he could recall. One might question if he had a brain in his head. But wait. She was as much a part of this trek to Tennessee as he. They had both prayed for a ministry with children, something they could do as a couple. And Cynthia had been eager and willing. It was he, however, who'd gotten the adrenaline pumping about Father Roland's deal, which, he now learned, came with a moose head in their living room, no bridges over their creeks, a rug chewed by dogs, and an infestation of mosquitoes. Down the road, maybe Hal's idea was indeed something to think about. Meadowgate had always held a place in Cynthia's heart, and certainly in his. It would give them something to look forward to while in Tennessee. He mused for a moment on picnics in the Owens meadows and long walks in the woods, on the background music of lowing cattle and crowing roosters. Best of all, they'd be with Dooley through the summer. They wouldn't have to make this wrenching disconnect. The thirst was profound, dredging up some odd anxiety he couldn't name. But aha! Right up the road was the little store he and Dooley had stopped at the other day. He wheeled into the parking area and heaved himself from the car and went inside. "Water," he said. 32, 33, around back." Absorbed in counting money, the man at the cash register jerked his thumb toward the rear of the building. "Around back?" "Spig it out back. 40, 45. The drink box is over there." Drink box. He walked to it as if through high water, his legs heavy. Coke, Pepsi, Sprite, Dr. Pepper. He couldn't drink this stuff. But he didn't feel like going around back, either. He dropped the change in the slot, punched in his selection, and pulled the handle. The can thumped into the dispenser. His hand trembled as he popped the top and drank, feeling the icy liquid flow down his gullet like a river of life, a benediction. He sat on a stack of drink crates and checked his watch. He was within 2 miles of Lottie Greer, Absalom Greer's elderly sister, who was still living in back of the country store built by her parents more than 85 years ago. He should go by and visit. It had been a long time. The fork in the road was coming up. He had 30 seconds to make a decision. He saw the marker, Mitford 7 miles, Farmer 2 miles, and noticed how, in the well-mown V of the fork, the weeds had been left to grow up around the marker post. His father never liked to see weeds left growing around a post. He veered left. He wouldn't go to Lottie Greer's. Everything at home was now on a schedule that, if interrupted, could throw them off the mark for their early morning departure. God willing, he would visit Lottie when he came back in September. He made a vow to do it. Absalom would have wanted it. He missed the old preacher who had loved Miss Sadie till death did them part, the preacher who'd hung on to what some called old-time religion. Indeed, there was nothing old-time about the truth of the gospel. It was instead a truth for all time, yesterday, today, tomorrow. Absalom Greer had never preached the fashion of the day, nor done whatever popular thing it took to fill his pews. He had preached the word and let the chips fall where they may. He would visit Absalom's sister for this reason alone. Speaking of visiting, blast! He hadn't gotten by to see Luella at Hope House. That wouldn't do. That wouldn't do at all. He stepped on the accelerator, hoping the sheriff's boys weren't lurking in a bush somewhere. Luella sat by her window, gazing out to the rooftops of Mitford. "Knock, knock," he said, standing at the open door of room number 1. "Uh-oh! Look at my shameful self. I'm still in this old house coat." "It's all right, Luella. You look beautiful in that color." "Lord knows I get dressed every day that rolls around. Today I say, Luella, ain't nobody coming that you got to impress." "And you were right. You don't have to impress me. I'm already impressed." "I don't know by what." He leaned down and kissed her cheek. "By your stamina, your positive attitude, your fine singing voice. Want to hit a couple of verses?" He sat on the footstool near her chair. He instantly felt 8, maybe 10 years old. Miss Sadie and Luella had always done that for him, made the years roll away. "I can't praise the Lord in this old house coat. It's nothing but rags and patches. Miss Sadie give it to me." "We'll just gab, then," he said. Nurse Carter stuck her head into the room, grinning. "Y'all going to sing today?" "No," he said. "We can't. Luella's in her house coat." "Oh," said Nurse Carter. "Cynthia and I are leaving town tomorrow," he said. "We'll be home for a week in September." For some reason, he found it difficult to put those two sentences together. He stood in the parking lot, trying to remember where he was and where he was going. He looked up to the roof of the front entrance and saw the Angel weather vane. Of course, he was at Hope House, and he was going home. He located the red Mustang on the other side of a Bronco and got in it, and drove down the long driveway to Lilac Road, turned left on Church Hill, and passed Little Mitford Creek on his right. As he approached the stop sign, he noticed that weeds were growing up around the post, and there was his father. His heart beat with a profound joy. As the image of Matthew Kavanagh appeared to him, an odd and severe explosion erupted in his head, and he felt his body violently jolted into a kind of limbo, a sudden darkness. Chapter 6 The Veil. "Father?" Dressed in dark trousers and a familiar plaid shirt, the man up ahead stood next to a road sign at the edge of a cliff. The man's right arm was lifted, as if shielding his eyes from a bright sun, though no sun shone. His heart pounded in his breast. To think it may be his father, dead all these years, and now alive and real, and wearing a shirt he remembered giving him at Christmas. The brown in the plaid was extraordinarily beautiful. He'd never known that brown might have this rich and glowing life. The man squinted in his direction, as if affronted by the interruption of an important thought. Yes, he could see clearly now. It was his father, his young and handsome father, the very image of the picture that had sat always on his mother's dressing-table in a silver frame. Tears stung his eyes. How extraordinary that he wasn't dead, that there would be another chance for them. He stood rooted to the spot, weeping unashamed. "Who is it?" demanded his father. "Who was he?" He looked at his arms, his legs, his feet. He was wearing loafers he'd put on this morning, and pants he'd picked up from the cleaners in Wesley. He felt his head and the hair lying about his skull in a fringe. It was this that inarguably identified himself to himself. "It's Timothy." His father knit his brow and frowned. "I don't know you," he said, then turned and walked off the cliff's edge as though out for an evening stroll. A voice murmured at his right ear. He felt a warm breath that cosseted his hearing and made it acute. "O God, light of lights, keep us from inward darkness. Grant us so to sleep in peace that we may arise to work according to your will." The voice ceased, and he waited to hear it again. Desperately wished to hear it again. Is that all? There came a kind of whirring in his head, as if of planets turning, and then the voice warmed his ear again. "Good night, dearest. I love you more than life." He could not open his mouth. It was as if he had no mouth, only ears to catch this lovely sound, this breath as warm as the tropical isles he would never visit. Nor had he eyes to see. He discovered this when he tried to open them. No mouth to speak, no eyes to see. All he could locate was his right and waiting ear. He tried to remember what the voice had just said to him, but could not. "Speak to me again," he cried from his heart. "Please!" But he heard nothing more. The water poured in through the top of his head, as loud as a waterfall, and rushed into his neck and arms and hands and belly and legs, and streamed into his feet. Immediately the wave came in again at the top of his head, and flowed through him once more. The water's journey was warm and consoling, familiar. It was as if he'd waited for this moment all his life, and now that it had come, he was at peace. Then he was floating somewhere, weightless, emptied of all doubt or fear, but not emptied of longing. More than anything, he longed for the sound of the voice at his ear, and the warm zephyr that came with it. The birdsong was sharp and clear. The sky cloudless. He was walking along a woodland trail, carrying something on his back. He supposed it might be a pack, but he didn't check to see. In trying to balance the thing between the blades of his aching shoulders, he felt the weight shift wildly, so that he lost his balance. He stumbled. The edge of the woodland path crumbled under his right foot, and he fell to his knees hard, and woke, shouting, "Lord, where are you?" He knew he had shouted, yet he hadn't heard his voice. The room, was it a room? Was black. Not even a street lamp shone. And the dream, was it a dream? Had been so powerful, so convincing, that he dared not let it go. "Where are you?" he repeated, whispering, urgent. "Here I am, Timothy." He lifted his hand and reached out to Jesus, whom he couldn't see but now strongly sensed to be near him, all around him. The tears were hot on his face. He had found the Lord from whom he'd thought himself lost, and lay back, gasping, as if he'd walked a long section of the Appalachian Trail. "Thank you," he said into the silence. Had he spoken? "And yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," there was the voice at his ear, and the soft, warm breath, "stay, don't go, don't leave me. I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me." He listened, but couldn't contain the words. He forgot them the moment they were spoken. "I love you, my darling, my dearest, my Timothy." A fragrance suffused the air around his pillow, and he entered into it as if into a garden. It possessed a living and deeply familiar presence, and was something like home. But what was home? He couldn't remember. His heart repeated the word, home, home, but his head couldn't fathom the meaning. "I came. Shift. Yes. It's soon." Voices. Voices interrupted by static, sounding like the radio that sat in the corner of the living room in Holly Springs, with broadcasts that left out entire words of critical war news and replaced them with air. "Did you? Kennedy?" "Right. Then some." "Twice. 7th leading cause. Death." "I, doctor, must too." "Wring neck." He grew weary of trying to piece together a puzzle that was clearly missing its most interesting pieces. He discovered he was longing for something so finely woven into the fiber of his being that it couldn't be identified. One might as well strive to put form and feature on vapor. Longing, longing, his spirit torn with it. Then he began to know. It was a gradual understanding, unfolding in him like petals opening after rain. He held his breath, waiting for the revelation he was certain would come. When at last he could name the longing, he felt his heart lift up with a sudden, stunning joy. He was longing for his wife. But he couldn't make sense of the word. His heart appeared to know its meaning full well, but his brain refused to step up to the plate. What was wife? Think, Timothy, think. His head felt as if a network of connections had shut down entirely, and an odd rewiring were taking place. Wife. His heart told him it meant something like comfort or solace. Yes, wife was solace. Chocolate was candy, candy was chocolate, solace was wife. Wife was also... He waited for the meaning to grow in his breast, then felt himself reading his heart as one might read a book to gather understanding. Wife was also wonder, his heart seemed to tell him. Yes, wonder and pleasure and delight. He liked this game. He had always liked games, really. Was quite good at Scrabble, and practically unbeatable at something starting with... What did it start with? With an M? But he was veering off into mist again. Now that he knew he could read his heart, he wouldn't feel so alone. What else, then? Wife was... laughter. He remembered laughter, though distantly. Laughter doeth good like a medicine, he tried to say. He fell into a kind of sleep in which his body floated, as if on waves of music. He thought it might be Beethoven's Pastorale, in which the crashing of the thunderstorm over the meadows would soon be heard, but the storm did not come. When he awoke, he found he'd learned yet another definition. Wife was peace. He felt someone caressing his hand, but couldn't open his eyes to see or his mouth to inquire who it might be. The touch was inexpressibly tender. He wanted to clasp the caress, to hold it to himself as insurance against what might come. Wife, he said, trying to move his mouth. Wife, he had discovered in his sleep, was a place one went when one was afraid or alone, or even senselessly happy. It was a place one wanted to be, a place one cherished. It was something very like home. Home, he said, and heard himself speak. But it's what he wants. It's the only word he's uttered in days. He can't go home. It's too soon. He could be here for weeks. We don't know where this thing is going. We could have help come in. Surely you could find someone for us. Perhaps Nurse Kennedy on her hours off? He thought the woman sounded close to tears, and wanted to rise up and protect her from the other voice. He was urinating where he lay, and could do absolutely nothing to prevent it. He felt it streaming out of him, and afterward was greatly relieved. He wondered why it hadn't soaked the bed beneath him. But, of course, he wasn't lying in a bed. He was in a hammock swung by his mother, and he was wearing knickers, and was barefoot and laughing, and she was singing. Baby, by, here's a fly, let us watch him, you and I, as he crawls up the walls, yet he never falls. I believe with six such legs, you and I could walk on eggs. Spots of red dot his head, rainbows on his back are spread. I'm not a baby, he shouted, in case she had forgotten. She laughed. Oh, really? Is that so? I did forget for a moment, I admit, but only a very tiny moment. He thought his mother the most beautiful woman in the world, more beautiful than the ladies in Ladies' Home Journal, and 900,000 times more beautiful than the other ladies at church. I'm five, he shouted again, flying through the air. You have a whole day left before you're five. I want this day to go on and on and on and on and... For always, he yelled. For always, whooped his mother. He felt secretly pleased that she wished him always to be four instead of five, though he would have hated being four forever. O Lord, you are my portion and my cup. It is you who upholds my lot. My boundaries enclose a pleasant land. Indeed, I have a goodly heritage. I will bless the Lord who gives me counsel. My heart teaches me night after night. He stood before his Sunday school class in his mother's Baptist church and recited the whole of the 16th Psalm, for which he would be given a coveted gold star to wear on his lapel. I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not fall. My heart therefore is glad, and my spirit rejoices. My body also shall rest in hope. You will show me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy, and in your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Forevermore. The phrase moved him deeply, and set him wondering about eternity and the souls of others. Miss Wright was smiling and nodding her head. While one part of him was 12 years old and sitting down after the recitation, another part of him, a vague and hazy part, stood dumbfounded with relief and joy that Miss Wright, whom he and everyone else loved, had not been killed in a car accident with her husband on Christmas Eve. Well done, Timothy. Thank you, ma'am. His heart pounded like a jackhammer. His face blazed. He suddenly knew that tonight, possibly even before, he would pray, Lord, show me the path of my life. Why can't we talk? He wanted to say to his father, who sat across from him at the kitchen table. But this question supposed that they had tried to talk and failed. They had never really tried to talk. He would attempt something else then, something more straightforward and to the point. After all, what if his father died before they seized the chance? He cleared his throat and felt the terrible fear of a man who, though poised on a diving board, cannot swim. Let's talk. Sir, he said. About what? His father was much older than the handsome man in the silver frame that always sat on his mother's dressing table. I don't know, he said, ashamed that he didn't know. Now that he had his father's attention, he remembered that he hadn't chosen a subject. Maybe about how we could communicate better. Communicate. His father repeated the word, looking as he often looked, inordinately bored. Why do you hate me? There it was. He'd said it. His breath failed. Hate you. He gulped air. Yes, I think you do. I don't know why. He was stricken by what he was doing, but more than that, he urgently wanted to know. His father was stalling for time, making him suffer. Talk to me, Father. Tell me why. The color had drained from his father's face. You are impertinent, Timothy. No, Father, I am your son, and I must know the answer. Rage flamed in him, but he resisted it. He was a man now. He had finished high school with honors. He had been accepted into a respectable and discriminating college. He would wait for the answer without asking again, and without begging or whining. He felt the heavy pounding of his heart. I have no idea what you're talking about, Timothy. I seldom do, in fact. His father rose from the table and walked stiffly from the kitchen. He shut the door, which usually remained open, behind him. He sat frozen, lest the slightest movement cause something in him to shatter. Then there was the whisper of his mother's dress, the gray file that sounded like dry husks of corn blown together in a breeze. She sat in his father's chair and reached for his hand across the table.
Love your father, Timothy, she said quietly. Pray for him.
I can't. I've tried, but it doesn't work. He wanted it to work, if only to please her.
It's time I told you something.
Her eyes were brown and dark. He felt he could see a kind of eternity in them.
Your father bears many wounds.
But it isn't right to inflict them on others, especially not on you.
No, it isn't right. Yet in many ways it's no surprise. His father treated him brutally. You know the verse from Deuteronomy?
Lots of people have been treated brutally. St. Paul.
But St. Paul had encountered Christ, and your father shields himself against even the remotest possibility that Christ would approach him.
Through the window, he saw his father driving away.
Timothy, your grandfather once horsewhipped your father in front of a great number of people. It was a vicious attack that left Matthew terribly damaged in many ways. After that incident, which wasn't the first of its kind, Matthew sealed himself up like a tomb. That's how he made certain that his father could never reach him again. He watched the Black Packard make a right turn by the hedge of myrtles and disappear from view. The loss he felt was sudden and immeasurable, different from any loss he'd ever felt before. "I'm sorry," he said at last, "but it's too easy. When he shut out his father, he shut out everyone else, too. He uses a terrible personal experience as an excuse to wound others." "Forgive him, Timothy."
"How can I do that? I don't know how to do that."
"I'll pray for you to be able to do that," she said simply.
"Do you love him?" he asked. It was a deeply personal question. His family did not ask deeply personal questions, and today he had asked an intimate confession of both his parents. She gazed out the window as she answered, "I thought I could soften his heart, could give him joy. I believed that love would conquer all."
"Do you still believe that?"
"Yes," she said, turning to look at him. "I still believe that. Please believe that with me." He'd attended college for 2 years, then gone on to seminary, perceiving his call to the priesthood as God's way of using Timothy Cavanaugh to bring his father into relationship with Jesus Christ. But his father died with a hardness of heart no mortal son could remove. He had tried hard to believe with his mother that love would conquer all, and love had not conquered. He felt a cool breeze on his face and heard the laughter of children. The children appeared to be sitting on a limb of the tree above his head, for he saw feet dangling among the leaves. One small pair of feet was shod in white socks and patent leather shoes, and the other feet were brown and bare.
"Father, is that you?"
"Miss Sadie, is that you?"
"It's us."
More laughter. The limb moved. Leaves trembled.
"What are you doing up there?"
"Playing." "Is Luella with you?"
"We eatin' cornbread and milk," Luella shouted.
"I declare," he said, shaking his head.
"Come up," crowed Miss Sadie. "I need to talk with you about something."
"No way am I coming up there."
"Father, if you want my advice, clergy needs to climb a tree once in a while."
"Else you go stuffy." "You'll have to talk to me where I stand," he said, being firm. What nonsense!
Well, then, Father, I want you to look out for Dooley and Lace Turner.
What do you mean, look out for them?
Don't let them drift apart.
What can I do about such things?
He was starting to feel positively huffy.
That's God's business.
I thought God's business was your job, replied Miss Sadie.
It is not my job to meddle in the romantic lives of people who are barely college age.
Oh, pshaw! What do you think I should tell him, Luella?
Tell him, do the best he can.
Do the best you can, Father. That will be enough.
Blast, he muttered, stomping away. He didn't like people thrashing around in trees above his head. How ridiculous! He was a balloon shaped like a man. His right arm, his chest, his groin, his legs were being filled with a familiar substance, though he couldn't have said what it was. There was a terrible fatigue in him, as if he had toiled up mountains, mountains he had not in the least wished to climb. Abba, Father, he struggled to pray, but was disconcerted by a loud beeping noise somewhere above his head. He opened his eyes and found he could see. He was in a dark place. It smelled of aluminum foil or possibly mouthwash. A narrow column of light shone through a door that stood ajar. Where in God's name was he? Their door wasn't on that side of the bedroom. Cynthia? He found he couldn't move his left hand. It hadn't yet filled up, so he examined the bed with his right. The bed was narrow, and he was alone. He tried to roll onto his side, but found he was tethered. Cynthia? Cynthia! The beeping grew louder, and the slice of light grew wider as the door opened. Father Cavanaugh! Who is it? Someone walked soundlessly into the room without turning on the light. Nurse Kennedy. She took his wrist and placed her fingers on his pulse. Thank God, she said softly. Where am I? He asked. She did something that stopped the beeping. You're in Mitford Hospital, she said. Welcome home. Chapter 7 Grace Sufficient. Dearest, he opened his eyes and saw Cynthia standing by the hospital bed. Though tears streamed down her cheeks, her smile was radiant. He found he could not lift his hand to touch her, though the sight before him was the most wondrous he'd ever beheld. He touched her with his gaze, then mutely examined her face with his eyes. Home. He was home. Whatever he had done, he would never do it again. He felt like a man who had been to a hideous war and returned at last to kiss his very doorstep. Timothy, she whispered, leaning down to brush her cheek against his. Come, he said. She lay down in the narrow space beside him, and held him, and wept. Dear God, what bloody foolishness! How many times are you planning to pull this stunt?
What stunt? Father Tim asked. The effort of speaking seemed monumental.
Making yourself comatose. You did it so well the first time, you thought you'd do it all over again?
Hoppy raised his voice as if his patient had gone clinically deaf.
Comatose? For nearly 48 hours. I suspect it all started with delirium from severely elevated blood sugar, complicated by a concussion from whacking your head. all of which resulted in grieving your wife and upsetting half the county." Hoppy stooped and squinted at Father Tim. "What the devil did you do to yourself, anyhow?" "Get out of my face," he wanted to say. He felt nailed to the pillow by his doctor's blazing stare. "I don't remember." He had some vague recollection of going to the country with Dooley, but not much more. "How high was my sugar?" "You don't want to know," snapped his doctor. "How did I get a concussion?" "You weren't wearing your seat belt." "When can I go home?" Hoppy walked to the window, scowling, his hands jammed into his coat pockets. "We'll take you out of ICU tomorrow, then 3-4 days on the floor. You'll be home Sunday, looking at a full month of recovery. To tell the truth, you'll feel rotten for 6 weeks." Hoppy had the grayish pallor Father Tim had often seen in him over the years. He knew it well. It was exhaustion, plain and simple. He supposed he was the cause. "You're pretty fired up."
"Yes."
Hoppy turned from the window.
"Because you don't listen. I talk, I preach, I warn, but you turn me off like I'm some know-nothing parent."
He decided to ignore this accusation. "What happened?"
"You blacked out while you were driving and hit..."
"Hit what?" Hoppy raked his hand through his thatch of gray hair.
"A stop sign at Little Mitford Creek."
"So what was it, Father? More of that infernal cake you ate last term? Or did you cut back on your insulin and try living by your own rules?" He had cut back on his insulin, yes, but only a little. As for cake, he hadn't had any cake. Coke, maybe. Or was it cake? No, it was Coke. Some glimmer of memory assured him. "Coke," he said. "I had a Coke at the country store, coming home from Meadowgate." There, his mind was back. "I thought I punched the Diet Coke button, but I guess I got the real thing. I skipped lunch, and then I was thirsty, and..." "I don't know," said Hoppy, shaking his head. "I just don't know." He thumped into the green vinyl chair by the bed and checked his watch. "You're a pain in the butt." He grinned at his doctor, whose bedside manner appeared to be in drastic ill repair. "Same back." Hoppy tried to smile. "We'll get through this," he said. He fell asleep almost immediately after Hoppy's visit, and woke with a start. Tennessee! What about Tennessee? He felt around on his pillow for the nurse's bell, but the movement exhausted him, and he lay panting from the effort. The phone! He could phone Cynthia and ask her. They hadn't talked about it when she rushed to the hospital this morning at 2 o'clock. Now it was... what time was it? No watch, no clock. How was he supposed to know anything around here? He noticed for the first time that a TV hung over his bed at a drunken slant, as if it might plummet into his face at any moment. Maybe there was a remote. He could get the time from CNN. He craned his neck and peered at the nightstand, but saw only a box of tissues and a glass of water. He decided that shouting for a nurse was out of the question. It would take more energy than he had, and worse, disturb other patients. He would simply lie here, then, until someone came, enduring the pounding of his head and the sharp sting of the bruise where his temple had gotten banged up in that business with the sign. He heard rain strike the window pane and felt strangely bereft and alone. He should be glad for the sound,
glad for what a spring shower would do for the grass and the garden, his roses. But he felt no gladness. In truth, he felt almost nothing. Was this how it would be during the long weeks ahead? And was it really his stubbornness and stupidity that had caused his wife such agony, his doctor to work overtime, and the ministry in Tennessee to go begging from the beginning? Emma's packet arrived with his lunch, which consisted of a pint of milk, a bowl of yogurt, and something he couldn't identify. Was it congealed tomato soup, or aspic, or worse? He tore into the saltines and read his emails. From ourbackyard@aol.com. That's a fine kettle of fish, Timothy. I suppose it was the moose head that scared you off. When you're up and about and ready to join us, I'll take it off your living room wall and hang it in your woodshed. Forgot to mention, you'll be heating with a wood stove, like the rest of us in Bear Creek Cove. Thank God for Richard and Trudy, who arrived yesterday and have already done the work of two hale men. Youth, that's the ticket.